Welcome to the Agile Book Club. Here are your hosts, Justyna and Paul.
Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Justyna. So, this is going to be an exciting one.
Yes. And there, Paul, even one more reason that I'm not sure if you are aware of. Today, we are having our podcasting anniversary.
Is this really our 12-month anniversary? So it's not the one-year anniversary of releasing our first episode, but it is the last episode of our first year. And I expect it to be a great one. I always say that, though, don't I?
Yes, you do.
Do I always say that? Yes. I feel like every other episode starts out with me saying, this is going to be a great one. I'm really excited to talk to this person.
Yes.
Well, what am I supposed to say? I watched her conference videos and she looks like a horrible human being standing up there and smiling with a ukulele like some kind of a nut. What am I supposed to, no, I can't say that. I'm supposed to be charming-ish.
Yeah, but also...
No, you...
No, Paul, yes. But also we have this privilege that we really choose authors and choose books that we are going to review. And we just choose nice people to talk with. So, yeah, there's...
That is true. That is true. Okay, so we already have a plan for next month. And I think we've got a plan for the month after that, too, right? Is that when we're going to do that one about thinking in bets?
Yes, yes, yes.
It's got to be coming up. So we've got our next 2 months plan. But after that, let's try to find a... It's quite a really horrible human being.
Yes. Let's have a fight. I think that it can bring us even more listeners.
Yeah, exactly. You know what we need to do? We need to find that writer who told Portia about the two kinds of writers.
Oh, yes.
But now I'm starting to give away some spoilers for the interview that's about to come. So that's something to listen to in the interview. As you're listening to the interview that's about to come, at the end of the interview, you know you've listened well if you know what I'm talking about when I say the person who told Portia about the two different kinds of writers. There'll be a quiz at the end. Pay attention. This is not a game.
Are there any rewards, Paul? Like shaking hands? Oh, it's impossible right now. Damn.
That's not a reward. That's a threat.
Okay.
Speaking of rewards, I just sent out our first reward. You know, we've got several people who very kindly helped to support the costs of doing this podcast, and one person in New Zealand has signed up at the $20 level. And so I said that if anyone signs up at the $20 level, from time to time, we'll send you one of the books that we review. And I noticed that in New Zealand, the New Zealand Amazon does not sell a physical copy of Klaus's book. If you live in New Zealand, you can only get the ebook on Amazon. And it's such a beautiful, beautifully published book. It's so colorful and artistic that I took a copy of one of the copies that Klaus gave me and I dropped it in the mail to her yesterday.
Oh,
speaking of surprises and gifts. So if you're listening, if you're listening, look for that in the post box and be sure to disinfect it when it shows up because it came from Corona hell.
Paul, I think that we should start a podcast like Corona Apocalypse or Corona Hell because we have so many great names and ideas about it. So. Yeah.
But no, we've already got a podcast that keeps us busy enough. And
that's true.
And this one is going to be a treat for our listeners. So please stay tuned now as... we go into our interview with Portia Tung, the author of The Dream Team Nightmare and a Master of Play. So, Portia, thank you so much for joining us. You know, we've known about your work for a very long time. For some reason, we've never crossed paths at any of the conferences where we've spoken. And so I'm sad that it's just on the phone for the first time, but I'm delighted to meet you and Justyna is as well.
Lovely. Great to be here.
Actually, Portia, I prepared something for you because a part of my preparing for meeting the authors of the books that we review is actually get to know them a little bit better before we have a chance to talk. And I noticed something that you are doing in many talks when you are on the stage, that you prepare a kind of like a user story. So I prepared a user story for today's interviews and it goes. As the host of the Agile Book Club, we want to keep Portia talking as long as possible in order to get as much knowledge, experience and ideas from her that will serve not only us, but thousands of our listeners. And I chose success criteria for that too. We have fun during the interview. Portia sings for us, because also that's something that I noticed that you do during your talks. Listeners learn about at least one new tool. Listeners get to know at least one story of Portia.
Lovely. Afle, and it's nice to see that we take Agile so seriously in this channel.
Yeah. Yes, we do.
All right, so let's pull that card into doing and see what we can do with it.
Yeah. Paul, would you like to ask the first question?
I'd love to. Portia, you know, the reason why we chose your book, this podcast is almost a year old now, which means that at this point we've reviewed about a dozen books. Some of them have been pretty heavy. Some of them have been pretty dense. Some of them have been pretty dry. And we felt like this is the second time since we started this podcast that we both felt like we just owed ourselves something fun. The first time was when we read Clark Ching's The Bottleneck Rules. And the second time that we thought, you know, we just want to have some fun while we're learning this time for a change. And so we chose The Dream Team Nightmare, which has been on both of our reading lists for a very long time. Can you tell us what inspired you to write a book in such an unusual and fun format?
Sure. So for me, it was really important to have fun while writing, because I was used to reading technical books, because having been a Java developer, you know, huge tomes of technical books, which I noticed that many developers used to prop up their desks and chairs rather than read. So I figured out that if I were to write something of value, it needed to be read. And most importantly, I needed to be entertained as the writer. So the idea was that if I could have fun whilst I wrote, then hopefully the book I produced would also be fun to the reader. And that's how I kind of delved into my treasured trove of childhood memories. And I remembered the well-loved book series of Choose Your Own Adventures, which I grew up with. And it was very similar in that, you know, you typically have a hero and they're faced with a series of, you know, challenges and questions, and you get to determine the outcome, as it were, of your adventure. And it was great because, you know, there was always more than one possible outcome. And, you know, if you died on your visit to the dragon because you were foolish enough to go on your own instead of bring friends and a picnic, then you could go back to, you know, page 57 and change your mind and have another go again. And the great thing, of course, of the Dream Team Nightmare is that the short chapters kept me entertained. It kept me writing. And I was surprised by the amount of flow, actually, that I achieved as I wrote the book. So yeah, I had great fun writing it, and it's good to hear that you had fun reading it as well.
And did you have any difficulties like with your writing process? Because at the same time you were having like a few separate storylines. How did you tackle that challenge?
I think writing is such a personal process, and it's very much like play, which is probably why I had such a good time with it. And I think it all depends, because it's not just about the format of the book you want to write. It's so much about your learning style and what will bring you the most creativity. But for me, it was really organic. And I guess it's one of the first times I heard, you know, the characters come to life in my head. So a lot of writers talk about this, where if you look at Elizabeth Gilbert, you know, she wrote Eat, Pray, Love. And, you know, she talks about the creative genius that just comes to visit you. So as the writer, it's not that because we're very clever and that we're able to come up with any of this stuff, but rather we are simply the conduit, right, through which the message is being channeled. And that was true for me, because the characters just started speaking to me as I wrote. And the more I wrote, you know, the more they clamored for attention. And so I actually just followed them, of all things. And I wanted to be a story for them, with them. And I guess that's why so many people come up to me and say, you know, they have particular favorite characters, and, you know, with a particularly, you know, troublesome character, which people might perceive as troublesome or challenging, such as Jason, they'll come up to me and, you know, ask me, interrogate me sometimes to see if I've been snooping on their team or if I've ever worked in their company, because how did I know this Jason? But indeed, you know, I think there are so many variations of us. We're all different, but experiences are probably more common than we think. It was actually a lot like programming. So what had happened was before I started using a writing tool, I just used Word. And then I used Excel to start tracking the endings using page numbers. But then I came across this lovely, lovely online publishing tool called Leanpub. And I'm a real fan of Leanpub. I don't know if you're familiar with them. But it's so much like writing code, but you don't even need to know how to write code. And back then I was a bit geekier. So, you know, I'd check into the repository and, you know, use their markup language and all of that. And now they have a web interface, so you don't even need to do that. But it meant that you can do, you know, integration testing at the click of a button. And it meant that I could test early and often. So once I discovered Leanpub, I did move relatively quickly to that platform. And even though you can, you know, release your book whilst it's being written, in the case of this book, The Dream Team Nightmare, I felt it was more appropriate for the reader to have the whole book. It was kind of unfair if they got to a dead end because I hadn't written it rather than because, you know, of the choice they made.
So how many possible endings are there?
There are 8 possible endings. And technically, only one of them is the happy ending, as it were.
Ah, okay. I was looking for unhappy endings. I was very pleased with myself that I managed to get fired within an hour of taking the job.
Oh, well done.
Yeah, Paul was playing the devil.
Fail early, right? Good to know.
What did you want your readers to take away from The Dream Team Nightmare?
It's really interesting, Paul, because if you'd asked me this, you know, a few years ago, I might have said something like, oh, you know, to pick up a whole bunch of tools and techniques that I've, you know, learned and applied through hard graft, and hopefully that will help them out. But now I look back again and at the book, and I think actually a lot of the joy that the book brought me was the fun in work. So for me, a lot of the chapters that are more interesting is when we go visit the team spaces and see, you know, the colorful, you know, decorations and team manifestos and things like that, that people had in their team spaces that I might have helped, you know, facilitate the creation of. And it's really just trying to inspire people to have a little bit more fun at work and recognizing that actually making mistakes is okay. How we learn is incrementally anyway. And that, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it's not just cats who have so many lives. So can we, right? Because every moment is a chance to learn and change, and we can behave differently. And, you know, you can have a different ending to your story.
And indeed, in addition to this, the examples of fun, the play and the colors and the creativity, one of the things that I thought was very honest from my own experiences about this book is how much fun people have when they finally feel like they're working towards an achievable cause. These are people who have been beaten down, and they feel that everything is hopeless. And when they get a sense of hope and a bit of self-empowerment, and they're actually doing something that they feel is worthwhile, even some of the ugly, tedious work that they have to do in order to dig themselves out of the hole in this book is incredibly engaging. The hours fly by and everybody just wants to do it. And it brings them closer together.
And I think that's a key point, actually, Paul. You know, clarity of the goal that we are asked to work so hard for, I think that's often missing in when the work that people ask us to do. So absolutely, that's why there's a tool in there to make sure we clarify the goals before we set off on a journey, right? All too often, regardless of whether or not you're doing an agile project or a waterfall one, you know, if the goals are unclear, then it's unlikely that you will succeed, and only a death march will ensue.
And Portia, you mentioned at the beginning that characters were kind of talking to you. And I think from the reader perspective, I also heard characters' voices like Jason or Jim, you know, you just have a feeling like, oh, such a typical Jason. And I have a question for you, and it's kind of maybe a little bit question with a little favor to ask you to tell us a story. Could you please share maybe some tips on what do you do when you have someone who is so resistant like Jason? How to work with person who has such a negative attitude like Jason?
Yeah. So I don't actually see him as having a negative attitude, which is this is the great thing, right? When you write the book, it forces you to love every one of your characters. And I think I love all of them equally. And if you asked me that when I had been working with a more lifelike Jason in real life, that would have been much harder at the time. But what I discovered was that working with someone like Jason, I learned a lot. First of all, you know, having those kind of critical analytical skills is a great attribute of a developer or any problem solver. And the fact that, you know, he was questioning everything meant that he was still in the game, that he still wanted to know the answer. What I find is that it's the quiet ones who don't participate and don't give you feedback and don't give you input. They are the ones that you need to make sure they're still on the journey or give them a ticket out, because they're not in it enough, right? So for someone who is, you know, more skeptical and seemingly negative, yeah, absolutely. So long as they're asking questions, they're still interested. I think, and that's an important thing to remember. And also, of course, you know, the notion that everyone adds value. And I think it's not so obvious, for example, if you have an evil queen on your team, right? But it's just recognizing that everyone is here and that they do have a purpose of their own and they do have strengths. And it's recognizing how we can best leverage those and for us to, you know, all live happily ever after, as it were.
But did you have an experience like in the book that you walked into the room and you were like full of enthusiasm and you wanted just to kick off the workshop, but then you realized that one of the person is kind of maybe not like questioning, but is skeptical towards everything. But on the other hand, as you said, sometimes we can't blame people for that because they've been in the particular organization for such a long time and they've been like constantly demotivated and it's hard for them to believe that it will change. So if you were in this situation, what would you do?
Yeah. So one of the things that I promised myself when writing this book was that it would be based on my experience. Obviously the characters don't exist in their form, exact form in the book, and they're kind of composite experiences of, you know, my adventures. But certainly, yes, that happens all the time. You know, I invite people to play and they don't want to play. So you're like, okay, well, I can't force you to play because that would be punishment, not play. So I think I've always taken quite a playful attitude anyway. And of course, it's disappointing if, you know, a great idea you might be excited about and people are not so excited by. But, you know, Justina, I think I'm just used to be the odd one out in my entire career. You know, it's rare that I show up somewhere where people are really excited to see me. Because, you know, as a change agent, people normally eye me with suspicion and go, how are you going to inflict change on us? And how much pain will there be? Right. I remember being surprised the first time hearing from somebody that so-and-so thought that I was really terrifying. Mm-hmm. And I had to go to the toilets and double check in the mirror to see if I were as terrifying as this person might perceive. And it was at that moment I realized that, you know, when you're a change agent, so much of what you represent can be scary, right? For people who are going into the unknown. Whereas for me as a change agent, it might be a little bit clearer, hopefully, you know, with a direction and goal and where we could be heading and with options and things. Yeah, so I respect that.
Thank you.
But the drastic changes to the way that we're working and living these days because of the coronapocalypse, one of the things that I think everyone is realizing is just how incredibly resilient and adaptable people are to even the worst situations. And so when you walk into a bad situation that's been bad for a long time, it's full of people who have acclimatized themselves to that. And anything else can be scary.
Oh, absolutely, Paul. And, you know, the smarter you are, the more quickly you adapt and the more quickly you become a zombie, right? And that's the point. And I think that's really interesting because, you know, so often I meet people who are change agent themselves, and because they are so smart, they adapt so quickly to environment that they've become the zombies too. And I think that's the key thing, you know, to stay fresh, to, you know, go to conferences and do different things all the time and constantly challenge yourself. So one of the things I don't think I added it in this book, but a tip I always had whenever I started working with a new team was I would set myself the goal of, you know, running a certain distance on the running machine or when I went out, because I would be, you know, traveling abroad to work with teams. And, you know, it wasn't just a matter of staying fit. It was getting fit, right? And it would remind me, just feeling my own heart pounding, trying to, you know, breathe in slowly and catch my breath and really desperately trying to achieve this goal. It reminded me that this is really what people go through as we go through change. And maybe not everyone is ready for it or wants to, and that's okay.
You know, in addition to sharing quite a lot of tools, and I really appreciated the nice list of them in the back of the book, so it turns the book into a reference book after you've read it as well. But in addition to all the tools that you wanted to share, I think there was something else that was very important, and that is the qualities of character or personality that are crucial to being able to drive change in a healthy way. And Jim has a way of looking at challenges and thinking about the people who are being challenged that is unlike many of the people around him. And I imagine it's his attitudes are probably reflective of your own when you're acting as a change agent. Could you talk a bit about the kinds of qualities of personality and character that help a person to be able to be a benign change agent?
Benign change agent, I like that. And indeed, useful to clarify that. I think if I look back at it now, a lot of it comes from non-judgment. So, you know, when I trained as a coach a few years ago, a professional trained coach, what I learned was to treat everything as data, stay with not knowing, and trust in the process. And when I discovered that these are the, you know, three recommendations they have for a coach, and I entered my own kind of coaching journey, I realize now that's probably what Jim believed in as well, but probably didn't know if it was true and that he would just try to do his best. And that's pretty much what I've done as well. And I think it's really important when we're learning to do these things to learn from people who've done it before. Because very often, you know, once I met an author, and an author said to me, "Well, Portia, it's really important you need to know this. There are two kinds of people in this world. There's one kind of people like me who's really smart and who writes great books that everybody loves." And I'm nodding and I'm like, okay, I'm waiting for the tip. And he says, "Well, then there's a second group of people and they're like you." And I'm like, okay, you know, let's stay open-minded. Let's see what he says. And he says, "Well, they're like you because they get their hands dirty on the ground. And, you know, they just mess about and, you know, eventually they might come to some solutions." And then he said, "But that's not me. I write books." And that was the other thing. So when I wrote The Dream Team Nightmare, another challenge I set myself is to really write from not just the heart, but from my hard won and lost battles, if you like, most of the time with myself rather than obviously with the people I worked with. Because of course, you know, when you're the change agent, you're the bottleneck to change, right? And I think one of the things we consistently fail to talk about, or at least fail to actually act on in an agile world, which is, you know, founded on continuous learning and improvement, is that we don't look at ourselves. So, you know, writing the book was a way of really holding up the mirror to myself. And that's why there are so many failed endings. It wasn't deliberate. It's because I have failed and failed and failed over and over again. And, you know, I have a great friend in the past who told me, you know, a dead agile coach is no good to anybody. And I often remind myself that now, you know, if I'm not in the game anymore, I can't affect change. So how can I change myself in order to extend the time I am in the game to bring the value that the people hired me to do?
And Portia, was there any other possible ending that you wanted to add, but you didn't? Any other scenario?
Justina, I'd say I do have another Agile Venture bubbling in my head. So not so much a different ending. I think the endings for this story is as they are, and I am contented with them. I remember reading this famous quote about poetry, which is, a poem is never completed, it is merely abandoned.
Oh, yes.
And the moment I came across that quote, I was like, oh my God, isn't that about everything we do in life? So perfectionism is really a pursuit of excellence as a challenge, but it's no good to believe that you can never achieve it. So with this, you know, it's a bit of fun, a way of sharing. So yeah, no, I'm happy with the endings there are, but was there one you could come up with perhaps?
That's a good question. I will think and I will tell you later. Because as if you heard our book review, we simply loved it. And you kind of inspired me as well, because I'm just right in the process of writing ebook. And I decided like, oh my God, Portia's book was so amazing because it forced me to keep the pen in my hand, you know, all the time when I was reading. I want the same experience for everyone who would read my ebook. So thank you for that. I will think about other possible scenario. If I come up with something clever, I will share it, the possible adventure. But I have one question that is maybe not 100% related to the book, but it's something that you mentioned a few minutes ago, that if you force someone to play, it's more punishment than a play. But is there anything that you could advise to coaches, facilitators, and trainers in order to bring some play to their training and their work? Like, even if they meet the team or a group of people that it's not so much willing to play, but what is like the safe play sample, if I could say like that?
I think it's really about being yourself when it comes to, you know, facilitating or coaching or being in service of other people. Because if you don't feel well in yourself, right? I think the French have a saying, you know, sentir bien dans sa peau, you know, feeling well in your own skin. If you don't show up as your authentic self, nobody else will want to play with you, because they kind of smell a rat. They're like, oh, this is just another game thing. And we see that so much, right? In the agile world, where we gamify everything. But then really, what are we doing? You know, we're just tempting the children away like the, you know, Pied Piper with clever music. But in the end, how are we really improving their lives? And I think when we want to use the power of play, then we have to remember that it's in service of the people, and therefore how they play and why they play is equally important. So it's really important for the facilitator and her coach to know themselves, right? To let themselves have fun and be seen to have fun in front of these people before you can expect someone else to play.
This is something that you could definitely speak to, and I'd love to hear what you have to say about it, because I've taken issue for many, many years with people who try to just add amusing diversions, the what kind of playful things can we take into our retrospectives because they're boring, without solving the real problem that the retrospectives are boring because the team isn't actually accomplishing anything in them. So what is the difference between play and diversion?
So Dr. Stuart Brown, who has written a book called Play and also given a TED talk, which inspired me on my personal play adventure, is, you know, he says, true play is fair play, safe play, and being a good sport. And he also says that, you know, play is seemingly purposeless. And I think this is the thing. What I've discovered is that play is never purposeless, because even if you've had a really hard day at work, Paul, and you think, oh, you know, I wish I could just sit here and watch the, you know, the full first series of Game of Thrones, you know, beer in hand and maybe some popcorn. And your wife comes in or your partner comes and says, oh, what are you doing? And you might say nothing. the truth is, it's not nothing, right? Because you're trying to de-stress, detox from the day so that you're ready and fresh for the next day. So what I've found that the key thing with play and work is that play does have a purpose, and that when you're working towards a purpose, you need to have more fun doing it. So for a lot of these people who try to make things fun in order to get to something, they would do better to spend time clarifying what that goal is rather than just throwing another icebreaker or throwing another exercise or how can we make this retrospective different so that it will motivate people. Well, the fact is it won't, because there are some problems that really need to be solved, you know, through logic and careful thinking and careful listening. And this is where the skills come in. And I think that's probably what I tried to express in the book as well. You know, people think that they can do a single certificate and maybe even online and not in person. And then all of a sudden, they are a master of some special skill. And in my experience, that's rarely the case. And it requires a lot of experience. So play and work together, but you have to work at it.
And referring to play, and Portia, what you said before, that you have to be comfortable with what you do and how you play, and in this way you can encourage other people. I have to admit that I was impressed with watching you on the stage and singing. And I was wondering, before the first talk in which you include singing, how did you come up with this idea of actually like making people dance like this, I don't remember, hands, knees and shoulders, you know, this song. How did you come up with this idea? How did you feel before you've done it? And how did you feel after you've done it? Because that looked like a lot of fun.
I guess a lot of the things I do, I don't do it for myself. I do it for the purpose of, you know, promoting happier adulthood through lifelong play. And I think, founding the School of Play, which is my company, that is our purpose. And I realize now that I've been pretty aligned to it all my adult life and actually much of my childhood too. And so I didn't feel afraid because it was my life's purpose. And if I didn't do it, nobody else was going to. So I needed to do it. So a lot of people think, oh, well, that's singing in public. But for me, it wasn't singing in public. For me, that was a way of warming up the crowd and enabling them to open their voices before mine. And I think it's such a respectful thing to do. It's also playful. And, you know, in those early days, I had a newborn child. So, you know, when you're in a room with a bunch of mothers and small children and you have to sing a bunch of nursery rhymes, you just sing it, right? There's no point in judging people of whether or not they're out of tune, because it would be ridiculous to even expect them to be in tune. And I know some people come up to me afterwards and says, oh, have you ever thought of what would happen if no one joined you in that tune? And I said, well, I'd finish the song. You know, that's why I got up on stage, right? And this is, yeah, going back to, you have to feel well, and you can't fake it, mm-hmm. I don't think, if you want to invite people really to play, because it's such an honest and earnest thing, and it's a gift. And if you pretend to offer a gift, but really that gift is nothing, or it's a snake in a box, then nobody really wants it. But it's that invitation to play, and, you know, it's purely optional as well. And there are people who choose not to sing, and I'm grateful that they choose not to sing, because that's their way of, you know, playing, and that's okay too.
And were you ever in the environment that was kind of against this kind of play, fun forms of, I don't want to say working, but, you know, of kind of existing? Like, I mean, if you work in the environment that was anti-play.
This is a serious business here. No triviality.
Exactly. Yes.
So it's funny. I'd say all the time. And so I'd say probably in the first 5 years of my career, I expected to work in non-playful places. And that's why I spent so much time going to conferences and submitting to conferences and doing my life's work there, so that I would recharge and experiment with ideas, which I can then bring back. It's a bit like, I guess, you know, fashion. You see fashion on the catwalk and it's completely different by the time it hits the high street. You know, the sleeves are less, you know, less loud, and it's the dresses are less flowy, but nonetheless, there's something still in the high street version of the catwalk outfit that has been retained. And that's what I did. I accepted that I didn't play at work in my early days and that I played somewhere else. And I think over time, I realized that actually with all the play science I've been looking into, that without play, you can't really have a place where humans can thrive and grow. So I'd say, you know, in the last 7 years, I've actively sought out places that support human growth, right? Not just growth of the economy or a quick buck. And I've pursued those places. And in fact, I have criteria. Now that we're friends, I can share this with you. I have criteria when I choose my clients. So the first one is, do they care about the people? You know, do they care about the people that they want me to work with, like their teams? So if it's yes, then we carry on to the checklist. The second item is, will they support those people on that journey? You know, give them the training they need, give them the time out they need, whatever it is, right, to rest and learn. And then the third criteria, if the second one gets ticked off, is, are they prepared to grow and develop and change themselves? I have to say that all my gigs that I take pass the first two, and it's rare for the third criteria to be met. But, you know, it's in setting these high goals for one's personal challenge, right, that strange things, wonderful things start happening. And I have, you know, I've found people who care about others enough to be willing to change themselves, right, even when the feedback may be perceived as negative, but actually it's an opportunity to grow. So nowadays I'm surrounded by people who want to play. And when I say surrounded, you know, it might be the entire org doesn't want to play, and it might be the 5%, but, you know, I have a good way of sniffing out that 5%, and we have a great time, and we're able to create lasting, enduring change that let people know it doesn't have to be full of suffering and pain.
I wanted to ask you about what you're doing now. Obviously, it was some time ago when you wrote this book. The Dream Team Nightmare was written by an agile coach, and it sounds like you're doing so much more than that now with the School of Play. Could you describe the sort of engagements that you're involved in, what sorts of things you're excited about doing now?
Yeah, so I'd say I have two jobs, really, professionally, if you like, not excluding parenting. I think that requires professionalism too, but that would be my third job. So I still do the agile coaching, but as more of an executive agile coach, because I'm a trained coach now as well. I work with executives when we do agile transformations, but I also just do executive coaching as well. And then on the other side, I do my play research and create, you know, a program actually called Playful Leadership, where we look at the attributes of play and the science of play and how we can use the way we play to develop and nurture our own authentic way of leading. And that's really exciting for me, because I think, you know, having grown up with a whole bunch of leadership books, you know, written by the greats, I've always sought, you know, this is what an authentic leader is. If you follow this checklist, then you'll be an authentic leader like Susan. But the thing is, I'm not Susan, and I don't do things the way Susan does. And that was so algorithmic, you know, so output focused rather than outcome, if you like. But more importantly, it didn't tailor to who I was. And so in trying to become more like Susan as a leader, I lost myself. And what I found through my play journey is that if you look at a lot of the adult development, it's so closely intertwined with child development. And actually, there's very little that really sets them apart. You know, what makes a child laugh will make an adult laugh. Right. And that's why the head, shoulders, knees and toes works. It's not a trick. It's because we know that that is the quickest way to know if we're still connected in terms of mind, body and spirit. Right. If you're singing that song and you don't quite know where your nose and your ears and your mouth are anymore, then that tells me we're probably working too hard and not playing enough. You know, just quick things like that are remarkable. So in developing the Playful Leadership Program, it really enables leaders. And when I say leader as well, for me, everyone's a leader. If we're not leading our own lives, who is it? And, you know, if we're not leading our own lives, should we really be in a position of leading others? You know, I certainly wouldn't want to be doing that. And that's why I spend so much time practicing leading a better life. Now, the curious thing, though, I have to say with this kind of play research is I hang out with a lot of very playful people. I mean, far more playful than I am. And the reason I got into play was because when I had my baby, I realized that I didn't enjoy playing with her, which was absolutely devastating. But also I was like, how come I don't know how to play? Because I've spent all these years playing with adults at conferences and inventing games. And that's the remarkable thing. You know, play is this pure thing that we are born with, but it also needs to be nurtured. And if we don't play every day and practice, you know, growing those parts of us that may not be exercised otherwise, maybe at work, then those disappear. And I'm really excited about this play research because by hanging out with these super playful adults, I've been able to observe that they typically have five key attributes that make them effective change agents, change makers, but also leaders. Would you like to hear
them? Yes. I was just about to ask you that. So you're a mind reader, right, too, I guess.
Yeah. So I call them the five R's. So the first attribute is that they are highly resourceful. So just when everybody else thinks, oh, no, we won't be able to do this podcast, it turns out that, you know, the organizers have at least one other option and then the show goes on, right? So this is what I found. You know, playful leaders are highly resourceful. And then as I watch them a little bit more, I noticed that they were also highly responsible. You know, they didn't just look out for themselves. They made sure that everyone else was having a good time or looked after, you know, psychological safety and had their needs met as we were going on a change journey, right? Taking responsibility of themselves, but also ensuring others are safe too. And then the third R is that they're also highly respectful. And, you know, as I kind of started observing these characteristics, I couldn't quite, you know, acknowledge what I was seeing because I was like, oh, these are really grown-up attributes that you wouldn't normally associate with play, right? Being resourceful, being responsible, being respectful. And then the fourth one is resilient. So, you know, if at first you don't succeed, they will try again, but they will try differently and they will try again and again and again and again. And, you know, research shows that most people will try something three times and then after that it's game over, they will give up, right? But you know, playful leaders will continue to try and they might take a longer break before they try again, but that's okay. The key thing is they will bounce back, right? And the fifth one, which I'm the most excited about, is that they are real, you know, a bit like Pinocchio becoming a real boy. And what did that really mean? And this was the thing, right? It goes back to what we talked about earlier, on the show, which is that unless you're prepared to go on a journey of your own to find out who you really are and to show up as you are, unapologetic, but simply just accepting of yourself, then magical things happen, right? People start listening to you and they start appreciating what you're saying instead of resisting because you're being real with them. And I was just absolutely delighted when I started looking at these characteristics. And then I thought, well, hang on a minute, how can play be such a mature thing? And it is, you know, to be able to continue to play as an adult is a massive achievement. When you think, you know, we spend more than 70% of our waking hours doing work or work-related activities, which for most people, they do, you know, in the form of a zombie, right? So if we're able to somehow still have a little bit of play in our lives, you know, if it means just skipping from your front door to the bus stop before anyone can see you, and then you get on the bus and you're all serious again with your books, that's okay, right? And so when I started mapping these attributes of playful adults, I started thinking, well, actually, they are what leaders are, right? Resourceful, responsible, respectful, resilient, and real. And of course, having my own child allowed me to hang out a little bit more with young children and observing them. And if you truly watch how young children play, these are the attributes they exhibit as well. Because they know that if I steal your toy now, Justina, you're going to be stealing my toy right after lunch and then hitting my head over it. So that would be unfair play,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, definitely. So, right?
Well, you learn to respect each other.
Yeah. So what was the, if you could just narrow down to one thing that you learn from your child?
I think my biggest and deepest learning is that for change to happen and for people, you know, to be the best version of themselves, it needs to come from a place of love. And there's nothing cliche about it. You know, a hug from a child is probably one of the purest things you can have. And if you really watch what it is they're after, it's not because they want that biscuit that you can only reach, you know, they need your help to reach that biscuit, so they give you a hug. If you really see what that is, they're trying to make a connection, you know, and they know how to, you know, soothe you when you're in trouble, and the things they offer. And people call that innocence, but I'm like, no, that's love, right? That's non-judgment again. Just treating everything as data and, you know, playing with non-judgment and just seeing how things will pan out, right? And yeah, so it'd be love.
It's lovely how these themes keep coming up again and again. One of the authors we interviewed made Justina cry when he first suggested that the goal of an agile or the role of an agile coach is to love their team and to love them in that kind of accepting, non-judgmental way.
And I'm easy to make myself cry, Polly. No, that's true. Portia, you almost made me cry.
And I think this is another point, I think, as well. To be emotionally intelligent, I really had no idea. Before I did my coaching training, I read the Emotion Intelligence book and thought, yeah, I got this. Okay, let's move on. And then I'd apply it. But I had no flipping clue. You know, and it's only when you get exposed and allow yourself to expose yourself to your own emotions, I don't think you can really interact in a well-functioning way with other people. You know, so many people are apologetic when they cry, and I'm like, well, hang on a minute, that's a form of intelligence. Did you know that? You know, when we cry, your body's detoxing. And also, hopefully, you've seen us crying from a place of happiness.
Yes.
You know, and I remember... Absolutely. And, you know, there's this assumption that we can tell what people are thinking when we look at them and how they're feeling. And there's science to prove that you can't do that now. So what we're teaching our negotiators and FBI agents is wrong. You can't tell how someone is feeling. And likewise, I cry when I'm happy. And at first, my little girl, she was taught at school, you cry when you're sad. Well, then, of course, that's the only time you're allowed to cry. But I cry all the time when I'm happy. And most of my tears are happy ones. And it's so interesting that until we get, you know, emotionally connected with ourselves, I don't think we can really be effective in what we do. So it's great to hear that love is fundamental, if you like, to the work we do.
Well, I'm delighted that you're doing it. It's good work to do, especially with the executives who have such a huge impact on the lives of so many people. And I want to thank you for doing it. And I also want to thank you for taking this time to talk to us. It's been absolutely delightful getting to know you. And I'm glad to hear that there's another book bubbling around in your head. I'm eager to read it. And I really look forward to seeing more of your conference talks. I look forward to another book from you. And I'm sure our listeners feel the same. Thank you very much. Thank you so much for joining us for this delightful conversation that we've just had with Portia Tung, the author of The Dream Team Nightmare and of another book yet to come from the sounds of it. Let's look forward to that. As always, we enjoy very much hearing from you. I understand that you're putting up with some audio degradation because we don't have our studio. I really appreciate your patience with that. I'm doing my best to edit for ease of listening, but it can't always be perfect. We're working out of our homes, and neighbors are doing construction, and police cars are going by, and children are playing, and damn children, what have you. What can you do with it? So we're doing our best, and I appreciate you sticking with us. And especially thank you so much for those of you who are helping to support the cost of this show by pledging their support on Patreon, and especially the woman in New Zealand who I sent the book to. So if you want to support the podcast, it's really easy. Just go to justbuymeacoffee.com and just buy us a coffee. We'll appreciate it.
And Paul, I was just thinking, if someone can't buy us a cup of coffee, at least just give us feedback or share some good words in Apple Podcast Review or in any other platform that you are listening to us. We would also appreciate that.
Yeah, that definitely helps to get the word out. So join us in 2 weeks when we will be talking about Commitment, a novel, a graphic novel, about managing project risk by Olaf Massen and Chris Matz. That's all for now. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.